Good afternoon, and welcome to the Green Thumb Show. I'm Lee Murray, your reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. Thanks for joining us. From the Arizona Republic, Hardscaping Gives Outdoor Space Aesthetic Appeal by Maddie McKay. Spring weather has brought us warmer temperatures and bright sunshine, and that might come with the desire to transform your boring backyard into a stunning outdoor oasis. But before you start ripping out those dead bushes and demolishing those overgrown walking paths, there are some things to know to create your dreamy retreat. Hardscaping is what adds structure, functionality, and aesthetic appeal to your outdoor space. This includes things like patios, retaining walls, walkways, water features, and lifestyle elements. Think of it as almost the bones of a landscape, says Rich Cording Sr., owner of CLC Landscape Design, based in Ringwood, New Jersey. It's complemented by softscaping, grass, trees, flowers, shrubs, and other living plants that, Cording said, makes an outdoor space come to life. Concrete pavers are the most popular material for hardscaping, Cording said. They're durable, easy to replace, and highly cost-effective. Plus, they repel heat and therefore don't get as hot in the sun as other options. Natural stones like granite, bluestone, and limestone, and sometimes even marble, are also commonly used for hardscaping, but they tend to be more expensive. Cording said these materials are best used in shaded areas or for walkways, as they can get very hot in direct sun. Travertine is another popular natural stone for backyard spaces, but its porous texture makes it susceptible to staining. Natural stone is beautiful, but it's a lot more expensive, Cording said. So a lot of the time people go with pavers for budget, but also because they are more practical in many respects. As for structures, patios and walkways continue to be the primary foundation for outdoor living spaces. But Cording estimates that 80% of the patios they create have an outdoor kitchen or a fire pit or both. Shade structures like pergolas, pavilions, or cabanas also are trending. Everybody was calling for swimming pools during the pandemic, and that's still one of the main things we do, Cording said. But most designs now revolve around outdoor living spaces with shade, a place to grill, and then usually a secondary space where people can go sit around a fire after dinner. You could start the process of hardscaping by assessing how you want to use the space, such as for dining or entertaining, and looking for inspiration online. You should also determine what your budget is and make note of any major landscaping or drainage issues. Then you should consult a licensed landscape architect. Cording said they'll be able to come up with a design that fits your wants and needs while also adhering to local laws, codes, and ordinances. We have a saying that great landscape starts with great design ideas. So we kind of have a synthesis of ideas in our company where we'll have multiple people reviewing it, and every time we review it, we come up with another tweak that makes it better, he said. A landscape architect will also make sure that you have proper permits for the work and an accurate timeline for how long it will take. Also from the Arizona Republic, Not All Bugs in Your Garden Are Pests by Brenda Daly. Bugs are actually an essential part of nature, but when they feed on our plants, stored food, wood, fabric, us, and our animals, they become a problem. Less than 1% of bugs are pests. Beneficial bugs pollinate, decompose, aerate soil, biocontrol weeds, and damaging bugs, are a food source for many animals, provide products like honey and silk, have medical uses, and some even have aesthetic qualities like butterflies. As master gardeners, we tell you to identify the insect before spraying an insecticide. I know that's hard. We don't want to kill beneficial insects, though. I'm not an entomologist, but I am capable of observation, and there are some computer apps like iNaturalist.org that can help with identification. As an example, by following integrated pest management, gardening solutions, principles, my first step was identifying aphids on the guara flower stems. I could spray a strong stream of water to knock them off, or cut the flower stems back and dispose of the infected stems and aphids and let the plant rebloom. What I observed was one different-looking bug among lots of aphids. It was the larval stage of a ladybug. They eat lots of aphids. Biological control had arrived. Spraying an insecticide wasn't necessary. As a reminder, insects have several instar stages from egg to adult, and they can look completely different in each stage. A good example is butterflies, from egg to larva, caterpillar, to pupa, chrysalis, to reproductive adult stage butterfly. Another way to control pests in the garden is right plant, right place. A plant that is stressed by inappropriate sunlight, soil, drought conditions, or injuries can attract pests. Plants also prefer certain temperatures to grow and produce. I tried to save a pretty edible red kale for seeds, but it turned into a trap crop for bugs, so into a plastic trash bag it went. Not all garden pests are bugs. Some are mites, arachnid, the spider family, and snails, and slugs, gastropods. There are some beneficial members of those families, though. Each one of those pests and beneficial creatures could be the subject of an article. I've previously written articles for the Jacksonville, Florida Times Union, part of the USA Today network, on the predatory rosy wolf snail by garden heroes who took care of a bumper crop of round brown snails and bark or tree cattle. I don't use poisons in my garden and usually just have a few eaten leaves. With time, patience, observation, and spot control, you too can move to a more natural, ecologically balanced garden. From the Chicago Tribune, the secret to a longer life, easy ways to get the most out of the season's abundant fresh basil and other herbs. By Adina Steinman of the New York Times. At markets this time of year, abundant, well-priced bunches of herbs can be just as tempting as strawberries and asparagus, but bringing them home often means that one's best intentions collide with harsh realities. Herbs can go from sprightly to swampy before you have time to use them up. The simple tips that follow can help you make sure they never go to waste. First, choose your herbs wisely. Look for the freshest herbs you can find, which can last longer in the fridge and freezer, suggests Nassim Alakhani, the chef of Sofre, New York City's Brooklyn, and author of the cookbook, Sofre. Herbs should be perky and vibrant, with plump, well-hydrated leaves and stems. Avoid bunches with wilted, limp, or waterlogged leaves or discolored areas. If possible, skip herbs in small plastic packages. Their condition can be hard to gauge. Prep your herbs for storage right away. Like flowers, herbs can't wait to be released from their packaging. Once you're home, spread out the loose herbs and pluck away any wilted or brown leaves that may have been hiding. The adage about rotten apples applies here too. If you have one bit of cilantro leaf that's been chewed up or damaged in some way, that's going to be a focal point for bacteria, said Donald W. Schaffner, a food microbiologist at Rutgers University. Alakhani also likes to rinse her herbs before storing them, which has another advantage. You'll be more likely to cook with herbs if you know they're washed and ready to go. But make sure they're well dried. Alakhani uses her salad spinner, but you can also blot them with paper towels, as residual moisture will travel with the herbs, contributing to bacterial growth, Schaffner said. Keep soon-to-be-used herbs hydrated. If you're planning to use all your herbs in the next day or two, pesto perhaps, go for a simple approach. Alakhani just washes them without drying and adds them to a quart container of ice-cold water at the back of her fridge. To ensure the herbs absorb the water well, give the stem ends a trim before immersing them. For longer storage, pack strategically. Herbs can't keep in the fridge for 1 to 2 weeks. They'll last longer when they have enough moisture to keep them fresh, but not so much moisture that they turn into a soupy, swampy mess, Schaffner said. To maintain that balance, Alakhani recommends wrapping well-dried herbs in a paper towel before tucking them into a resealable food storage bag in the fridge. But Schaffner cautions that may retain too much moisture. My recommendation is just to make sure that everything is as dry as possible before placing it into the bag, he said. Whatever you choose, be sure to use a generously sized bag or container to ensure air circulation and seal it well. Handle living herbs with care. You might assume a plant will stay fresh longer than cut herbs, but without proper care, it can quickly fade. If you have herbs growing in your garden or on your windowsill, aim to harvest them early in the day and use sharp kitchen shears to avoid damaging them. If bringing home a hydroponic plant, remove it from its wrapping, then trim any wilted leaves or mushy-looking roots. Place the plant in a jar with water coming up just past its roots and set it on a windowsill that gets indirect sunlight. Change your water every day or two to keep the roots healthy. Use as vegetables, not just garnishes. No matter how deftly you handle herbs, their freshness is fleeting, so use them with abandon while you have them. Persian cooks like Alakani already tend to follow this approach. "We buy herbs by pounds in Iran," she said. "They're not garnishes. They are our food." These strategies will help you use up your haul long before they wilt. Stir handfuls of chopped herbs through everything. Pots of warm rice, soup, stew, pasta, or risotto turn instantly vibrant when finished with herbs. Let them star in salads. Add a generous helping of chopped dill, cilantro, or parsley, including the tender stems, to your next salad. Or just make herb salad, aka tabbouleh. Add herbs to ground meat recipes. Stirring plenty of finely chopped herbs into ground meat mixtures for meatballs, burgers, and meatloaf doesn't just add flavor. It also helps keep them tender when cooked. Blend up an all-purpose green sauce. Creamy, silky, tangy, or spicy green sauces tend to work with any combination of herbs. Use them as a marinade, a topping for grilled or roasted meat or seafood, or a dip for bread or vegetables. When in doubt, turn to eggs. Frittata, quiche, and savory egg pie would never say no to a handful of herbs. Egg recipes can go as green as you like. If herbs are past their prime, cook them down. Even tired-looking herbs can still infuse longer cooking dishes with flavor, and their texture isn't as important since it'll soften up as they cook anyway. Add a pile of chopped herbs to a braise, stew, or soup as it cooks. When all else fails, freeze them. Having fresh herbs is good, Alakani said, but is it essential? No, it's not. When you're caught without fresh herbs, freezing them saves the cook's life. Start by packing a finely chopped herbs tightly into an ice cube tray, then fill the tray almost to the top with olive oil or water, freeze until solid, and transfer to resealable bags to keep in the freezer for up to 2 months. The oil-based cubes are handy for enriching soups, stews, and pastas, while the water-based ones can quickly infuse a smoothie, lemonade, or frozen cocktail with flavor. If you'd rather not put anything but water in your ice cube trays, use a freezer bag instead. Mix chopped herbs with a few spoonfuls of oil and transfer to a freezer bag, pressing to flatten into a thin, even layer. The flat layer of herbs freezes especially fast, which can be an advantage. If you're going to freeze something, you want to try to freeze it as quickly as possible, Schaffner said, to preserve quality. When ready to cook, simply break off a piece. For a more straightforward option, bundle up an herb cigar of parsley, dill, or cilantro, wrap in plastic, and freeze. When you need chopped herbs for a recipe, use kitchen shears to quickly snip off what you need. It may not be the same as fresh, but the flavor still lasts. From the June issue of Sun Lake Splash, Saguaros Like Summer by Dennett Hunnell. The last week of April gave us the pleasure of observing the blooms of the saguaro cactus. It's only for a short time frame, but is beautiful to see. People are amazed when they see the blooms for the first time, but saddened to see that the rubbery white blooms last only for a day. First-time viewers flood social media with the rare sight. The saguaro is Arizona's state flower. It stands as the worldwide symbol of our great state 48. Now is the second best time to plant saguaros. If you do, remember a few key rules. Do not water for 4 weeks and plant facing the same direction it was originally growing so it doesn't get sunburned. Yes, it's true, they do sunburn like those first few days, just like us. Saguaros make a statement in any yard, regardless of the style of home. You'll find they become part of the family, as this statuesque companion is part of your landscape for generations. Removing a large, healthy saguaro is a major undertaking due to their immense weight and legal protections. Be sure you want this commitment before you invest and plant your saguaro. Here are some facts about our Wild West symbol. First, pronunciation, the go, is silent, sounding like a WH. It's said saguaro, a word originating from indigenous peoples of the Sonoran Desert, meaning giant tree-like cactus. Saguaros are all over the Sonoran Desert, Arizona, southeastern California, northwestern Mexico. Most begin growing arms and blooming between 35 and 60 years of age or when they reach 7 feet tall. The more arms they have, the more water they store. Birds rely heavily on saguaros. You'll often see small holes where birds nest for safety, shelter, and hydration. Saguaros can live to be 150 to 200 years old and grow 40 to 60 feet tall. If consistently hydrated, they can weigh up to 4,000 pounds. Historically, when a saguaro died, its woody ribs were used to build furniture, roofs, and fences. The spines are now often encased in tubes with pebbles to create rain sticks, a popular Arizona souvenir. Permits are a must to transport a saguaro for any reason. It is illegal to tear down or destroy a saguaro on federal land in Arizona. The blooms we see in April appear in dense clusters atop the arms and crown. They open at night and remain visible for approximately 24 hours. With a rubbery texture and scent of overripe melons, they attract pollinators, bees and birds like the white-winged dove during the day and the long-nosed and the Mexican long-tongued bat at night. By summer, red fruit blooms and splits open, showing juicy red pulp with up to 2,000 small black seeds. The fruits can be made into syrup for jam or wine with a flavor similar to plum. The seeds can be dried and used for chicken feed. It's a delight to wake up to the saguaro blooms each year, if only for a day. It's worth the wait. From the June-July issue of Phoenix Home & Garden magazine, English Cottage Garden, Sonoran Desert Style, Lush Florals Reimagined for the Desert, by Laurie A. Johnson. A cottage garden in the desert sounds at first glance like a contradiction in terms, especially when valley backyards are more typically shaped by heat, sun, and limited water. Yet for Gilbert resident John Miller and his partner Kyle, the concept works thanks to containers and an abundance of lush florals more commonly associated with temperate climates. The result isn't a literal translation of an English cottage style, but a looser, more local interpretation that keeps the layered, informal feel while recognizing the harsh realities of the Sonoran Desert. Born and raised in Michigan, John got an early start in horticulture while working all 4 years of high school at a greenhouse, where he learned basic gardening principles from seasoned gardeners. In those years, I would bring home plants from work all the time, and I began to curate my own garden at my parents' house, he says. During this time, I fell in love with growing flowers in containers in particular. Not being able to grow outdoors during the winter was a main motivating factor for moving to Arizona, where I could grow flowers year-round. He began his desert life in Tempe, where he attended Arizona State University and graduated with a degree in horticulture, later moving to Gilbert after meeting Kyle. When John first moved in 6 years ago, the backyard was mostly a blank slate. We had a grass yard with a 10-foot by 20-foot cement slab in the middle, which I use as my display garden now, John says. The patio display evolved over time and expanded to its current state, which John views as a never-ending process. I take it season by season and alter things that I liked or disliked the previous year, he says. Cottage style is all about seasonality and layers. It's less structured than a desert-style landscape and more colorful. Accomplishing this takes a great deal of advanced planning to change out the selection of plantings over time as the seasons change. Because we do everything in pots, we always have flowers blooming in the main display area, he adds. This requires a lot more work and preparation, since we need a section of our yard dedicated to our prep garden, which is basically where we have the next season's flowers getting rooted and growing out. Once they get added to the main display, they will be ready to put on a show. John and Kyle grow a variety of flowers themselves, but due to limited space, they also purchase some from local nurseries. A revolving selection of containers is key to John's cottage style. We like to term it as playing musical pots, he says. He uses terracotta vessels almost exclusively for their durability, despite being more expensive than plastic, which tend to become brittle over time in the summer heat. The display garden consists of several large tiered plant stands with the largest pots and tallest plants in the back for overall height, graduating down to the smallest plants to fill out the bottom rows. We create a mini microclimate when we clump the pots together. They help shade each other and protect the plant's roots from the sun, he adds. Because the main patio display is in full sun, John waters as often as twice a day in the heat of summer. The garden's lush color palette also evolves with the seasons. Adding colors that represent the seasons gives the landscape a sense of seasonality that is sometimes missing in warmer climates like Arizona, John says. We love using color palettes for each session, such as pastels for spring, warm peachy tones for summer, autumnal shades for fall, and soft, cool tones for winter. While the spring palette is John's favorite, due to its embodiment of the English garden aesthetic with its striking burst of tall delphiniums and foxgloves, he also looks forward to designing around other seasonal favorites, such as Lisianthus in the summer, Celosia in the fall, and ornamental cabbages in the winter. John's favorite thing about living at Gilbert is that he and Kyle can garden year-round, not just for themselves, but also for private clients where they share the workload planting in-ground seasonal flower beds in addition to containers. The pair operates a flower garden installation company that came about as a direct result of sharing their lush plantings on social media. I found that there was an interest in the floral displays I was creating and posting on my social media because of the cottage-style aesthetic, which is so rare in hot climates, he says. I wanted to make flower gardening an art form where structure, uniqueness, color matching, etc. were all emphasized. Thus, the business manifested itself organically over time, and I get to provide a service to people where I get to share the things I love most. John's advice for aspiring flower gardeners is to embrace trial and error while learning through experience. Green thumbs are not given, they are earned. And those of you who are regular listeners to this show know we feature stories each week from the terrific book, Chicken Soup for the Gardener's Soul. This story is called Hummingbirds in Hell's Kitchen. It was written by Hillary Nelson, submitted by Connie Goldman, excerpted from Goldman's book, Tending the Earth, Mending the Spirit. And there's a quote here, an English proverb, every man's neighbor is his looking glass. Hummingbirds in Hell's Kitchen. I used to live in Hell's Kitchen in New York City, and that's where I learned how to garden. We lived on the third floor of a crumbling brownstone, the kind of place where the landlord has no phone number, just a post office box for the rent. One day, a salesman sent me a flyer for mail-order roses. I looked out my window at the empty, forlorn lot below me and then sat down and ordered three rose bushes. They came about a week later, three 18-inch thorny sticks in a plastic bag filled with soggy newspaper. What are you going to do with them? My husband wanted to know. Well, I answered, we need to build a window box, and then we'll hang it up outside the window and plant them. What we? He asked, and then started off for the lumber yard over on 10th Avenue. Filled with potting soil and roses, the window box weighed about 300 pounds. I was terrified that the people who lived downstairs might come out into their yard just in time to get flattened as the box pulled free of the deteriorating brick wall. But it hung there, and in June, pink buds began to swell. One Sunday, as we sat reading the newspaper, I suddenly smelled them. At least 10 blossoms had burst open in the hot morning sun. They sat blushing and nodding as the city breeze wafted their perfume along with the sound of the M11 bus into our apartment. Soon, wonderful things started happening. People would stop me on the street. I know you, they'd exclaim. You're the one with the flowers. Very nice. People would call up from 48th Street. What are they? Roses, we'd shout back. Que bonita, they'd yell. Gracias, we'd yell back. Eventually, my first floor neighbors moved out. We grabbed their apartment sight unseen because those roses had made us so land hungry. In the tiny courtyard, I planted nicotiana and foxgloves, columbine and ferns, hellebores and viburnum, all of which could thrive in the dim light at the foot of the tenement. Woodpeckers visited, and hummingbirds the size of bumblebees. At night, bats swoop by, devouring mosquitoes and moss. One morning, I found a local hooker junkie asleep under the gardenia on a sheet she had swiped from my clothesline. She was very thin, and her pale face was covered with welts. I suspected that she had AIDS. You got a very nice yard, she remarked. It don't smell like the city. As I led her out through the dingy hallway, she turned and said, from here you'd never know something so nice was back there. She walked away, swinging her skinny arms and singing cheerily. About a year ago, we moved to New Hampshire, to a house built by the Shakers. From my kitchen, I can see a lilac bush planted 150 years ago. With all the windows shut against the cold spring night, its scent still fills the house. I designed an elaborate garden made of box beds in a geometric shapes, divided by gravel paths and with a tree at its center, potager it's called. It's based on the medieval gardens grown behind monastery walls. It's a little paradise, my Garden of Eden, and I love it. But I learned my most important gardening lesson back in the big city. I don't ever forget that there are hummingbirds in Hell's Kitchen, that roses grow on tenement balconies, and that a garden prompted a prostitute to sing. It's our nature to find beauty, even in the most unexpected places. Without it, humankind would have died out long ago from sheer misery. And that is why I give thanks for gardens. That's called Hummingbirds at Hell's Kitchen, written by Hillary Nelson, submitted by Connie Goldman, excerpted from Goldman's book, Tending the Earth, Mending the Spirit. And that's the Green Thumb Show for this week. For Sun Sounds Radio, I'm Lee Murray, your reader. Thanks for joining us. Have a great week. Be safe and healthy. And we'll be talking with you soon.